A quorum is present. We're going to jump right to the agenda. We're changing the numbers to accommodate some testifiers, and we're moving Senate File 1534 to right after Senate File 1077 to accommodate them. So. Okay, so Senator Kubley, would you like to present your 1077 bill, please?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1077 is asking for an appropriation that looks at some homelessness problems statewide. It's an issue that in the rural parts of the state, I think is, you know, homelessness is relatively invisible. You know, people don't see them very often because they're in out-of-the-way places, but I do think that they're out there. Well, I know they're out there. I've seen them when I'm out running or exercising, but they kind of leave their night dwelling kind of early in the day, so we don't see them very often. But anyway, with me today is Liz Coppola with a homelessness organization here in town, and I'll let her tell you a little bit about the need, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Liz Coppola. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. And I work out of Eveleth, Minnesota, and one of my side jobs is I serve on the Eveleth City Council as well, and so I understand kind of the budget crisis we're all in, and this is an appropriations bill, but I think it's really important. What the Continuum of Care does is it provides someone who can help pull together a big federal application for funding. It brings Continuum of Care bring in over $20 million a year into the state of federal resources. And back in the day, in the 80s, every little individual homeless program would apply directly to the federal government, to HUD, for funding. And they got so many applications and had limited resources. So they said to communities, how about if you form a Continuum of Care, a group of folks who are providing services in the community, you figure out in your own communities what we need. And so in Greater Minnesota, we have six different regions that work on Continuum of Care building. And it's a mix of service providers, and they get extra points if they have community people like police officers or school people or whatever at the table to figure out what applications should be funded and to rank them, and then it goes as one big application to the federal government. In rural areas, one of the issues we see is that when we don't have the capacity to do grant writing and things, so that's absent this bill. This bill helps with this issue, but no capacity means that we don't have any outreach, and no outreach means we can't prove a need, and no proven need means we can't get resources, and no resources means there's a greater need, but no capacity means that we don't have resources to address the need. So I'd like to just bring one of the coalition's works serves with each of the Continuum of Care regions across the state. We don't get any of the money. We just provide technical assistance and are there to help with application. But I have a message from just the Northeast region. At a typical monthly meeting of the Northeast Continuum of Care, which represents six rural counties in Northeast Minnesota, Aiken, Carlton, Cook, Lake, Itasca, and Cooch, there are representatives from 15 to 25 organizations providing services and housing to homeless persons. Despite limited budgets and the necessity of traveling great distances to meet, this group has worked tirelessly over the past 10 years to secure over $3 million from HUD for projects to end homelessness through support services, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing. They've also created a number of new projects with other sources of funding and have worked to efficiently coordinate services to best meet the needs of the overwhelming numbers of homeless and near homeless people who are often hidden in rural communities and small towns. Current funding allows the Northeast COC to hire a coordinator for approximately one day a week. With this limited staff time, she is able to coordinate the annual application to HUD and organize monthly meetings. But in previous years, when there was more funding, We were able to organize meetings and activities of local homelessness and housing coalitions, such as the Aiken Homeless Coalition, to address local homeless needs and secure local resources, organize trainings designed to educate people about rural homelessness, bring housing resource people, such as MHFA, DHS, and others, to the region to provide information and technical assistance to Northeast organizations, assist Northeast organizations with applications for other sources of funding, and coordinate volunteers for the annual shelter count and Wilder's statewide homeless survey. And so very, very important work. I know as a city councilor, one of the things we're looking at now is a 2010 census and the need to just count every single person. And I think that that's one more way that these continuum of care coordinators can help us in rural areas, just make sure that everybody's counted and that we can get resources to serve them. So thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubel, you're really coming around. You're using witnesses from my district. I like that. And this is a good bill, by the way.
They're probably as visible up there, Senator and Mr. Chair, as they are in my district. I think, you know, homelessness in rural areas is just, you know, it's not as out front as it is here in town, and yet it does seem to me that it's definitely there. So we need to try and address those problems.
Senator Kubley, is there anybody else testifying for you?
Well, I don't. You could ask if there's anyone in the okay. room that would like to testify for or against it. That would be.
Is there any? Please come forward.
Good morning, committee members. Mr. Chair, I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm executive director of Elam Transitional Housing, and also with the Minnesota, the National Coalition for the Homeless. I want to speak on behalf and in favor of this bill. What happens when folks are not served in Greater Minnesota in their own community is they have to move to the next larger city or to the urban area, which creates additional burden for us as service providers here in the metro area. Elam serves over 6,000 people a year. We do have some folks coming from Greater Minnesota, whereas if the resources were there for them to apply for the different grants that are available on the federal level, they would be able to have the resources to serve people in their own community so people don't have to leave their own community to get services and to have a place to call home. Obviously, there are millions of dollars coming into the state from the federal level that rural communities are going to, Greater Minnesota communities in these continuum of care areas are going to be able to apply for. But without the capacity to do so, those dollars may not be able to be used in those communities. They are great stimulus bills and will help create jobs and create housing opportunities for people in Greater Minnesota. So I strongly encourage that you support this bill.
Could you spell your name, please?
Sure. Sue Watlow, W-A-T-L-O-V, Phillips, P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wished to testify on this bill? Senator Tomasoni moves Senate file 1077, and that it will move back to the Committee on Economic Development and Housing. Is there any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Motion passed. Thank you, Senator Cooper. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know money is tight, but appreciate any consideration.
Next file up is Senate file 1534, Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate File 1534 is a bill requesting funding for a demonstration project for high-risk adults. And, adding to what we've done in the past through the Department of Corrections and trying to make sure that people who are, have been in prison and come out of prison are successfully put into society and start becoming contributing members of the society by getting housing and getting jobs and keeping down the recidivism rate and basically giving them their lives back. And I'm going to turn this over to the witnesses so they can explain the success of the program in the past and why the need for this bill is here today and what the request will be, because we have some blanks in the bill. But I think this is another one of those projects that we've seen some very good returns on, and more than worth doing. So who wants to go first?
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 1534, which will provide continued funding for an ambitious demonstration project for high-risk adults. My name is Steve Thomas. I'm the president and CEO of the Network for Better Futures, and I'm joined at the table today by Mr. Makram El Amin, who's one of our team leaders, and two representatives of the network community, Mr. Derek Bacon and Vincent Brinton. Derek and Vincent represent over 120 formerly homeless men currently enrolled in the network. The men in our network community are all employed, and they're actively engaged in making a better life for themselves, their families, and our community. During its 2007 session, the legislature had the foresight to invest a modest amount of state funds in our bold, cost-saving endeavor, and I'm very pleased to report that we've met or exceeded all the performance expectations that were set for us. Quite simply, we have emerging evidence that the network is a proven means for reducing state spending, ending long-term homelessness, creating new jobs, and achieving much better results for an expensive group of high-risk consumers of public services. This morning, we'd like to introduce you to our innovative enterprise and summarize some of the key performance highlights from our first year of service. And then we'll close by making a case for continuing to invest in our enterprise in spite of the current fiscal crisis. First, some background. The network is reducing the economic and social cost of high-risk adults, primarily African-American men, with histories of incarceration, substance abuse, mental illness, chronic unemployment, and homelessness. This ambitious endeavor was created and is being sponsored by a team of Minnesota's leading healthcare, housing, workforce, community corrections, and human services practitioners. A core feature of our venture is Better Futures Enterprises, the network's business unit, which creates jobs for this high-risk, unemployed group of adults and provides immediate short-term employment. By setting high expectations and providing direct access to the resources one needs to meet these expectations, that is housing, health insurance, behavioral health and primary health care, short-term employment, and community reengagement, men in the network are offered the opportunity to become contributing, productive, and positive members of society. The core ingredients of the network's approach are proven means for ending homelessness, increasing earned income and child support payments, and reducing prison recidivism and criminal activity. And during the next biennium, we're willing to share some of the financial risk if these better results are not achieved. And now, Mr. El Amin will take a few minutes to share some of our performance highlights from 2008, and then I'll close out our testimony.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. El Amin.
Thank you, Steve. And good morning, Chairman and Committee. I am Makram El Amin, a team leader with the network, and I'm very pleased to present some initial data about the performance of our enterprise in 2008. We formally launched our endeavor last January, and during our first 12 months, we've enrolled 224 high-risk men. 136, or 60% of these men, were enrolled under our contract with the Department of Correction. About 70% of these men meet the state's definition of long-term homelessness. A third of the legislature's appropriation was used to provide housing. We now master lease over 130 apartments and provide rental subsidies to all of our participants. This enables men to secure and to afford the type of quality housing they're really able to afford on the open market. All of our men are working full or part-time with private employers, or they're working part-time on our Better Futures work crews. Nearly all men have histories of drug addiction and alcohol abuse, and a very high percentage of men are coping with a mental illness or some other type of behavioral health issue. To address these issues, all men receive physical exams and behavioral health assessments to identify concerns in these areas, provide access to appropriate services, and to promote better health. In 2008, the men reported they have paid over $80,000 in child support. Through our business enterprise, we created more than 30 new jobs and provided reliable, quality labor to private employers. In addition, we have used the legislature's appropriation of $1.55 million to leverage more than $4.8 million in other sources of private and public investment. And finally, we are about to engage researchers from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York to conduct an independent analysis of our performance and calculate the economic and social benefits of our work, including the amount of savings that we're generating for the state.
Great. Thanks, McCrum. Mr. Chair, if I may, I'll close this
Mr.
out.
Thomas?
Our initial success has been significant for a couple of reasons. First, we're paid to perform, and in the next biennium, we're prepared to reduce our fixed rate by 25% if we're funded to double our enrollment. And we are willing to enter into a financial risk-sharing agreement with the state. This reimbursement approach, which is quite unique for the social service world, provides a real incentive for us to produce much better results. A second reason is that our approach is based on some proven practices that have been documented to reduce homelessness, increase employment rates and better health outcomes, and maintain public safety while reducing recidivism. And finally, our partners' collective track record and collective power enables us to perform at a high level and meet expectations. Let me just briefly close with some remarks offering some reasons for why the state should continue to sustain and grow a cost-saving endeavor like the network during this time of fiscal and economic distress. We believe that the current economic crisis provides the legislature with a compelling and rare opportunity to be inventive and to reform ineffective practices and to reduce spending on expensive options like prisons and other types of institutional settings. And Senate File 1534 provides partial funding for the type of bold, path-breaking reforms that are needed during this time of fiscal crisis. But serious reform is disruptive, and reform forces a change in current practices and the status quo. Serious reform also entails more than tweaking a line item or an across-the-board spending cut. Our reform addresses complex issues that benefit multiple agencies and sectors, but it's hard for those current agencies to adopt and finance our new approach. Senate File 1534 and similar bills being considered by other committees will help fuel the growth and development of the next generation of more effective public services for high-risk people. The network's financing model, a fixed time-limited rate, pay for results, not activities, and pay a penalty if certain negative events occur, provides a better way to ensure that intended results are achieved and that the value of scarce tax dollars are maximized. And the network is a platform for government and nonprofits to become much more enterprising and nimble as we look to get better results with fewer resources. Also, we intentionally enroll higher-risk adults who demonstrate some willingness to change. Research indicates that the targeting of scarce resources on higher-risk populations generates the greatest financial and social return and provides the most benefit to public safety. And third, Senate File 1534 is an investment strategy that will generate multiple benefits for multiple state sectors within a relatively short time frame. And along the way, we will reduce spending and control future costs on more expensive services. Housing is a core feature of our cohesive approach, but no one agency or sector can assemble all the necessary funding or assume complete responsibility for a path-breaking endeavor like the network. And finally, by continuing to invest in and grow the network, the legislature will ensure that more than 60 formerly homeless, high-risk adults will not lose their housing or, for many, their jobs. And by losing their housing, jobs, and community support, they will be much more likely to return to using very expensive state-funded services, and we lose the economic benefits. With this ongoing support, these men and many more like them will follow through on their commitment to transform their lives, to be productive workers, healthy people, responsible fathers and partners, and law-abiding citizens. The expectations are high, and some would even say too lofty, but the network provides the proven ingredients, the accountability, and the environment needed to ensure that these bold aspirations are realized. I just want to briefly offer our two members of our community today to say a few words. Vincent Britton, I just want to make a few remarks, please.
Good morning. My name is Vincent Britton. I just want to say that I'm grateful to have an opportunity like this to even come and speak to the committee and just to share you know, some of my experiences with transitioning from prison and having where I couldn't get a place of residence because I had never rented or owned anything. So having an opportunity to for someone to rent to me, the network was there, and I didn't let them down, and I'm still here, and I'm thankful. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Britton. Could you just spell your name for the record?
Britton, B-R-I-T-T-O-N.
Good morning. My name is Mr. Bacon, and I'm grateful to the network for the great responsibilities they gave to me to take care of other men. I run one of the housing programs where the men first come through the housing, and I teach them how to live in a house by themselves, how to clean, how to make sure their body's clean, the household, how to shop, and so on and so on. So I'm truly grateful to the network because without them, I would have been back in prison by now.
Could you repeat your name? And
My name is Derek Bacon.
Just as it sounds? Okay, good. Senator Tomasoni, there's no fiscal number on here.
Mr.
Did
Chairman,
you have something
for
purpose, to?
For purposes of this bill, Mr. Chairman, I'll move that on lines 1.7 after both dollar signs, insert 1 million.
Is there.
You should vote on that, probably.
Can we vote on Senator Tomasoni's amendment, please? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. It's included. So, Senator Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, how much was put in this program last time?
You guys know that?
Yes.
It was in corrections, I believe.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, the legislature appropriated $1.6 million last biennium, the correction, and that went through corrections. And the point we're making is that although there's a lot of benefits on the public safety side, there needs to be multiple investments. So that's how it breaks out last time and what we're seeking now.
Mr. Chair, are you expecting to get
Senator Marty?
Department of Corrections funding again?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, we're not in the corrections base. We were one-time funding last biennium. Similar to this bill, we're seeking a similar appropriation from the public safety side also.
Mr. Chairman, just a general comment on it, and that is this kind of program seems to be a perfect example of what we ought to be doing, and I have a feeling if the biggest frustration I have about it is that it says demonstration project instead of something that's working we should be expanding elsewhere. And I know Senator Tomasoni with the budget, these are the things that have the most trouble making it, and they're the things that would have prevented us from being the shape we're in. So I wish your efforts could multiply a lot faster than moving from 1.6 million to 2 million. This is the time we need it most, so.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, these are definitely the kind of programs that have a bang for the buck and things we should be doing to get Minnesota back to what it used to be. And that's why I'm hoping we can find some money in the budget to figure out how to fund something like this. So,
and Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, you have another bill on Mead Jobs Program type of thing, reinstating that. Is that have any chance of getting funding this year?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Senator,
Chair,
Marty,
Senator Tom,
I guess I don't know the answer to that question just yet, but I know that it was a successful program back in the 80s when we had a similar type of economy, and we thought that it might be a pretty good idea to try creating some jobs. I personally believe that we can do as much stimulus as we want in up front with money being poured into different programs, but I think we have to work our way out of this recession, and I firmly believe that our number one job here this time around is creating jobs, and that's one of the kind of programs that can create jobs. So, does anybody else have anything to say here?
One question from me, from Mr. Thomas: is there a waiting list to get into your program?
Mr. Chair, yes, there's two, and you got to remember we have multiple referral sources. So we have a contract with Hennepin County.
So we're limited in how many men we can enroll who are either coming from our partner agencies or from the workhouse, but similar backgrounds to the men here. And then with corrections, again, the funding, we're limited number of slots. So I think we've actually, in about another week, we can't enroll anymore. And we're just going to have sufficient resources to serve out the folks that are already enrolled.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, if we could get some millions of dollars from the JobZ program, which hasn't had much results, and put them in these programs, I think it'd be a great way for economic development, a great way for helping people get jobs. I don't think you could make a better trade-off than that.
You know, and Mr. Chairman, we were just telling Senator Ortman's district to see how JobZ isn't working, so maybe that's a really good place to get something from. I don't know.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Questions? I guess,
Chairman,
we can.
If that's the case, I'll move that Senate File 1534 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Economic Development and Housing.
Senator Tomasoni has moved Senate File 1534 as amended. All those in favor?
Aye.
Say aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Tomasoni and Senate File 1382.
I have an A2 amendment that I have to put on the bill to get it in the shape that it will work. So I'm told by council that this needs to be in here because of the way the bonds are sold and what they're used for. So I'll move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor?
Mr. Chair, do we have it? I guess I haven't seen it.
It's coming.
All right.
We can wait a second. Senator Tomasoni moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, by saying aye.
Aye.
Passes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senate File 1382 is a request for $100 million in nonprofit housing bonds from the Housing and Redevelopment Authority. And this is about affordable housing and about people being able to move into houses. And basically what I'll do here is I'll turn this over to my witnesses and let them explain it, because this is another one of those bills that will have us going in the right direction and actually have a very good return for the dollar. So who wants to go first?
Good morning. My name is Alan Arthur, and I'm the president CEO of Aon. Aon is one of the leading developers, owners, and managers of affordable housing in the state of Minnesota. We have been around for about 23 years. We've done more affordable apartment homes for homeless people than any organization in the state of Minnesota. Interestingly, we've also done more historic preservation than any organization in the state of Minnesota, which is part of our understanding that communities have many needs, not just one, even though our passion and mission is affordable homes for people. I often start out presentations with four words. Those four words are air, water, food, home. Home's pretty high on the need scale for human beings. In today's world, I might add jobs, based on where we are today. And this bill is about both homes for people and jobs in the current situation. It does, as the senator said, proposed to issue $100 million worth of bonds that would be issued by the Housing Authority and then backed by the pledge of the state. It would be available to acquire vacant and boarded homes and rehab them. It would be available to help construct a backlog of 6,700 affordable housing units across the state of Minnesota, many of them ready to go right now. I think close to 1,000 units that would close by the end of this year. I know we have three projects and properties that are ready to close and go and move forward. It would also help acquire land for homeownership through the community land trusts that are scattered around the state, and I think make a big difference and impact, of course, on providing jobs for people in the state. Metro housing construction has dropped 70% since 2005, from about 18,000 actually starts to a little over 5,000, and the average over the last 10 years is about 15,000. So we got a ways to go to help buffer that. It is during that period about 16,000 construction jobs have been lost. The bottom line is, I think that this bill would help us, again, provide those jobs across the state as well as provide affordable homes for people. In today's climate, we're seeing more and more people who have lost their homes. Interestingly, 40% of the foreclosures out there have impacted rental properties. I don't think that's generally known. And that has a big impact on folks at the bottom of the economic ladder and makes a huge potential difference if we can, you know, find ways to provide homes for those folks. I think what I will do, I think, in the end is just to tell a story about a man who came to me the other day. He was homeless, looking for a job, actually, and looking for a place to live. And he asked how he could get into our homeless housing. Again, we've done more than any organization in the state. And I told him to get in line because the line is for the least line, the smallest, the shortest line in any of our homeless housing is 9 months. And we're seeing more and more people lose their jobs who live in even our housing. And the time used to be that they might lose it for a month or two, then they'd get back and find another job. And I worry that today that's not possible. And so this combination of homes and jobs, I think, will be really critical for us to move the state forward. And I'll leave it at that and maybe be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned 40% of foreclosures relating to rental properties. I hadn't heard that statistic before. It's alarming. Is that 40% of foreclosures, and then some of them would be multi-unit dwellings, so the number of families displaced in foreclosures would presumably be much higher.
That might be units. That might be units foreclosed. That might be units. I'd have to look at I can dig that information out and get that to you.
Dig that information out, because that's an interesting statistic.
It is.
I think that it is missed on a lot of people. And if it is 40% of foreclosures are rental units, and then you factor in the multiple unit dwellings, the number of families displaced could be bigger. So
yep, thank you.
I'd like to see that. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, it's
Senator Tomsoni.
In some of those cases, they're foreclosing on the entire apartment building, and the people who are paying their rent are being evicted.
Mm-hmm.
And
we've heard those horror stories, and so if it were, you know, even much higher number than the 40, it'd be good to know and be talking about in broader communities as we travel the state.
Chairman Kilosh, Senator Lurie, we'll get that information.
Thank you.
Good morning. Chair Kilosh, senators, my name is Jeff Washburn. I'm the director of the City of Lakes Community Land Trust. We're an organization that serves the city of Minneapolis. I also serve as co-chair of the Minnesota CLT, or Community Land Trust Coalition. We represent 9 community land trusts that cover the majority of the state of Minnesota in our service areas. And collectively have we've assisted over 650 low-income households purchase permanently affordable homes in the state of Minnesota. Two-thirds of those homeowners actually live in greater Minnesota, and about a third of them live here in the metro area. The vast majority of those homes have been made affordable through funding by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's Challenge Fund, which has been incredibly important to our success over the past several years, as well as a good portion of the mortgage loans that land trust home buyers are able to take advantage of are also financed through the state finance agency. Of those 650 land trust homeowners, we've seen over or very close to 100 resales now, and we've been able to keep those homes permanently affordable for the next generation of homeowner through the community land trust way of home ownership, where the affordability investment that we put into making homes affordable is tied to the value and the title of the land, which allows us a legal mechanism to ensure that that home stays permanently affordable for the next generation of home buyer. Land trusts have always required 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. Nationally, we've seen one-thirtieth land trust homeowners are one-thirtieth as likely as other homeowners to fall into foreclosure. We have an owner-occupancy requirement. That's part of our relationship with the homeowner. We have programs not only front-end for pre-purchase but also post-purchase training. And as I shared, that importance of making sure that an investment made today in helping a household purchase the home stays not only help the next home buyer but multiple generations of home buyers if and when they purchase a home. As you're aware, there's a number of federal dollars that are being passed through the state through the NSP program, and we estimate, at least in the city of Minneapolis and from what I understand in the state of Minnesota, those funds will probably go to address maybe 10% of the foreclosed homes in the state. And as Mr. Arthur mentioned, a good portion of those homes are households that were investor properties. I believe that in North Minneapolis, over 50% of those homes were investor-owned properties, so they were renters living in North Minneapolis who were displaced through that program. Land trusts are part of a larger continuum of affordable housing, that if we help folks into an affordable, solid rental situation, they get a job, they get their financial ducks in a row, they're going to be looking to take that next step, and I think often that next step isn't going to be conventional home ownership if they don't have the funding and the mortgage ability to do so. And organizations like ours and Habitat provide a bridge for folks to take that next step into home ownership that's responsible as well as supportive in helping them make that next step. The bonding funds would allow us additional opportunities to leverage the dollars that all of our organizations have already raised to make and create additional affordable home ownership opportunities in the state of Minnesota. And these funds, coupled with challenge fund dollars, local funding, private dollars that we all raise to make our projects work are really instrumental in creating the housing opportunities across that spectrum. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Council can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think this $100 million doesn't go against the state's bonding authority because it comes out of the housing agency, but the $8 million in debt service would be from the general fund. I think that's accurate.
Mr. Chair, my fiscal analyst is nodding his head, so I think that is true.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni, is there any? You have another name on the list?
I don't know. Do I?
Oh, Sean Allen.
It's the two of us.
Just the two of us.
Or just the two of you today? Thank you. Is there any other testimony?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Sue Watlow-Phillips, Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing, also President of Integrated Community Solutions. Just a few comments very briefly on the bill. We support the bill. One, it's a statewide program, which is very important that these resources are available statewide. It does coordinate well with other resources. As testimony indicated, we are seeing a great number of rental investment properties that we're losing out of the market. Elam Transitional Housing, again, serves over 6,000 people that are at risk or experiencing homelessness. We screen all the families coming into Hennepin County shelters, and we're seeing 7 to 12 new families coming into the shelter out of rental investment property primarily. These resources would be able to utilize that rental housing and put it back in the market as affordable housing. The one question I have on the amendment that you added to this bill is that it says maintain as affordable housing or sell to another local government or a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We would just request that the housing be maintained as affordable housing if that does occur. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, before Ms. Watlow-Phillips leaves, I wanted to ask all three of them. Last year in the House File 380, there was a requirement for Housing Finance Agency to meet with stakeholders to consider the use of these nonprofit bonds as a means to prevent foreclosures and so on. And I heard from some advocates that they had not been consulted. Have any of you been talked to by the agency? Are you familiar with the report they were supposed to do? just curious because I have a, I was curious because I heard from some advocates that they had not been
Mr. Washburn?
Talked to.
Chair Kilosh, Senator Marty. We have had discussions with the State Housing Finance Agency. We are involved in a meeting, I believe, next week that will go into further detail. And there has been a memo from the State Housing Finance Agency indicating that belief that these funds would work for land trusts in the state of Minnesota tied to the affordability investment being tied to the title of the land.
Mr. Washburn, I had that memo. I'm just wondering how that limits or what that is going to do for the land trusts, having these funds limited to just the land and not the house on top of it.
Senator Kilosh, Chair Kilosh, we believe that in our case, I can speak to the city of Minneapolis. The land values in Minneapolis, the appraised values have ranged from approximately $30,000 upwards to $100,000. The affordability investments have also typically ranged anywhere from $30,000 to typically $60,000 in affordability investments made in land trust homes. We feel that these funds funded, in addition to other levels of funding from local and private institutions, would be secured by the property itself, the land value.
Thank you, Mr. Washburn. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask the other two, because the legislation said that the agency shall meet with stakeholders, described in paragraph B, for the following purposes: consider use of nonprofit bonds as a means to prevent residential mortgage foreclosures and address the effects of widespread mortgage foreclosures, consider means of community activity, set aside mortgages more accessible to neighborhood land trusts, and consider alternative tax classifications, et cetera. Then it says they shall report the results and recommendations of the meetings. And I was just curious, have you had meetings with them? Have you gone over all the, in other words, the big picture look at how this money is spent?
Chairman Kilosh, Senator Marty, I know that we have constant meetings with the Minnesota Housing. I be honest with you, both me and our staff, I'm not a part of all those meetings. Of course, we're one of the producers directly using the $30 million, and so we would, of course, would have those kinds of interaction and meetings, and they're both collective with a number of organizations as well as ours. Whether they've met the test of the legislation, I do not have any idea.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, maybe I guess I don't need to ask him right now, but Housing Finance Agency, I just wondered, because you were supposed to report back to us. I haven't seen the report. Maybe it's there, but I was just curious because I'd like to see what the consensus was among all the groups and everyone on whether we can improve how this is used. And
is there any other questions? I see Housing Finance is here. I'm not sure if they would like to testify to Senator Marty's question about how that is going.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. When we learned that the work group had been directed by the legislature, we concluded that there was a group that had been meeting for at least 2 years, the Foreclosure Prevention Partners Council, looking at all aspects of foreclosures. And we are part of that group. It is a very broad-based group. And we thought that rather than duplicate the work of another group that had been going on for a couple of years, that we would continue our participation in the Foreclosure Prevention Partners Council and let that group do their work about what sort of funding needs were necessary to address the foreclosure issue. So it was a slightly different way of getting at the question. So what do we need to deal with the foreclosure issues? And then how could 501c3 bonds be used to deal with that? So we sort of did two tracks. We continued with participation in the Partners Council, and then we, on our own, explored the legal issues around the use of 501c3 bonds. And the memo that you have, Senator Kilosh, refers to discussions internally last summer about various ways we could use the 501c3 bonds to address foreclosure issues, particularly around the issue about home ownership. because that's what we were hearing from communities, is they wanted to have help with maintaining, retaining, bringing people back into home ownership. The problem with 501c3 bonds is that, in respect to home ownership, is that the property that's acquired with the proceeds of the 501c3 bonds must be owned by a nonprofit. We explored things like lease to own, things like that, and we couldn't get there. So in the meantime, the Foreclosure Prevention Partners Council was developing a financing plan, which we thought was appropriate to let that larger group develop a financing plan. At the end of July, Congress appropriated a large amount of money for foreclosure neighborhood remediation. In September, the agency was informed that they were going to receive nearly $40 million of that money, and we had to act very quickly. So everybody sort of stopped the, you know, financing plans and started working on how are we going to spend the federal money. So we didn't finish the report, but we did all of the work. But we had a very tight timeline on the federal money. Minneapolis and St. Paul, Hennepin County, a number of other jurisdictions that were most affected also had this very tight timeline. We focused our efforts on making sure that we could secure the federal money. But we did do all of the groundwork and did look at the issue that we were asked to look at as to how 501c3 bonds could be used. And I have talked with a number of people about that. We are following up with a meeting next week to again review if there are any other possibilities. I think we were we tried to look at what people were telling us was needed to address the foreclosure issue, and then look at how the resource could be used, as opposed to we maybe have this resource, how could we use it? And it seemed to us that that would result in a more comprehensive and thoughtful response.
Thank you. The memo that you sent me is going to be passed out. Oh, you got it? Okay, thank you. Is there any questions? Senator Tomasoni?
No, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I guess I'll move Senate File 1382 as amended to be recommended to pass and be referred back to Economic Development and Housing.
Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Bill passes. Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 1269.
Getting tired here, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry?
I'm getting tired here.
Senator Tomasoni, you just get to see what happens when the other side is sitting out there in front of your committees.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1269 is the most difficult $1 to collect that I've ever seen in my entire life. And I think I want to start out by, I have a delete all amendment, and then an amendment to the delete all amendment to get the bill in the form that I would like to have it in. So I'm going to move the A3 delete all amendment and then move the A4 amendment to the delete all amendment.
Senator Tomasoni moves the A3 amendment.
Wait,
delete
Senator,
all
Senator Fishbein.
We don't actually have the amendment.
No, they're passing it out right
okay.
now.
Okay.
Thank you. Getting them both.
Do you have to delete everything? Do you have to delete everything?
Senator Tomasoni, while the amendments are being passed out, would you like to speak to this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I do or not. I think maybe I'm going to let my witnesses explain
okay.
this bill because there's two sides to this story. And
okay.
and for some reason, getting people to pay a buck a month is extremely difficult here.
Okay.
And how you collect it and what you do with it. So Let's put it in the form I wanted in, so we're working off of the bill.
And sure, then, offers amendments, and then, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Senator Tomasoni moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that this is Senator Tomasoni's author's amendment, but are we going to get an explanation?
What I'm doing right now is amending my – this is the first time it's been in front of any committee, so I'm just putting it in the form that I want it to be in so that you can then react to what it's going to look like. And then they'll explain it, and there's going to be opposition, and we can decide what to do with it after that, okay?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I understand that, but
I
want to make sure that we understand.
I'm not doing anything tricky here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I said nothing of the sort.
It's just regular. It's just how we do things.
Senator Tomasoni?
I'll just move the A3 to start, and that's to delete everything amendment.
Is there any other discussion on the A3 amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. And then, we'll discuss the A3 amendments, Senator Tomasoni?
No, Mr. Chairman. Now I want to move the A4 amendment.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni moves the A4 amendment.
Which is an amendment to the A3 amendment.
Okay.
And then the bill will be in the form that I want it to be discussed in.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, this is an author's amendment, too? I just want to check.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, just
this
checking.
Is an author's amendment, yes.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Ayes have it. We can discuss the bill.
Now, Mr. Chairman, this bill deals with the process of collecting and transferring funds to the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund, and the difference between the amendment and the bill is that the bill, as introduced, eliminated the existing process that related to the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund and modified the property tax refund chapter of law. Basically speaking, we're trying to come to some kind of an agreement here on how this money should be collected. So I'll turn this over to Justin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Justin Bell. I am the legal and policy director for All Parks Alliance for Change. APAC is a statewide organization that represents the interests of manufactured home residents across Minnesota. The Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund provides manufactured home owners throughout the state with protection for their homes in the event of a park closing. Generally speaking, manufactured homeowners own their homes and rent the land underneath. The Minnesota State Legislature made a decision in 2007 to establish the trust fund and protect these 50,000 families and households across the state. Homeowners contribute $12 to the fund annually. All administrative costs related to the trust fund come out of the homeowner contributions every year. That's why this is so important. The current method of collecting the $12 from each homeowner has not worked. The process is confusing, inefficient, expensive, and often gives the impression that the contribution is optional, which is clearly not. Homeowners must contribute to the fund to be eligible for compensation should their park close. Less than half of all manufactured homeowners in Minnesota paid into the fund in 2008. That means that residents of these parks are not eligible for compensation under the fund if their park closes, and the fund is currently underfunded by more than 50%, leaving homeowners who have paid into the fund at risk of losing out to an insolvent fund. In addition, there's hundreds of manufactured park owners who have not complied with current law, and the residents of those parks haven't even been given the chance to be eligible under the fund so far. These are often smaller outstate parks, and those are also often the most vulnerable to closings. Under current law, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency will advance the trust fund money in the case of a large park closing or simultaneous park closings that would result in the fund being insufficient to cover all eligible homeowners. That provision expires in July of this year, so we need to fix the collection method now. We spent two sessions working with park owners to try to come up with a compromise, and all those attempts have failed. So what happens right now in Senate File 1269 is we take the complicated method that we have currently and that's ineffective, and we make it very simple and straightforward. The state assesses every park owner $12 for every licensed lot in their park. They're allowed to then pass it on through rent. For example, just saying starting X date, your rent is going up $1 a month to cover your contribution to the trust fund. That makes every eligible homeowner covered. That makes the trust fund completely solvent, and it makes the process very simple. And I have with me today two manufactured home residents who are members of our organization. I'd like to ask them to come up and just say a few words. Our president, on the agenda, we had our president, Bev Adrian, was unable to come, so we've brought our vice president, Paul Ruby, and Sandy Boone as well.
Welcome to the committee.
Go ahead.
Chairman Kilosh and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak on behalf of the manufactured homeowners. I live in a manufactured home in St. Anthony.
Say your name for the record.
Oh, my name is Sandy Boone.
Can you spell that?
Is it B-O-O-N-E.
Thank you.
Like Daniel.
Gotcha. Okay.
I own my own home, okay? I have homeowner's insurance on it. I pay taxes. I support the businesses in my area. And I vote. I do not, however, own the land, as was mentioned earlier, on which my home sits. So if the owner should decide that they want to close that park and have it used for, you know, another purpose, I would be displaced. Now, I would prefer to relocate my home somewhere else or to be compensated for it if that is impossible. In 2007, as our attorney at APEC mentioned, this legislative body did pass a law, a bill, that was for that purpose and was supposed to do that, okay? They created that fund, and we agreed, as manufactured homeowners, in order to get that bill passed, we agreed to put $12 in a year. So there would be something there to work with and defray cost. It was intended to cover all manufactured homeowners across the whole state of Minnesota. And I thank you very much because some of you were involved in passing that law. But after two legislative sessions now, it's not working. And the money isn't going in there. In fact, I'm one of those people that's fortunate. I did understand because I was helpful in getting that, presenting that bill with APEC. But we don't have sufficient funds in there so that even though I've paid, there could still be a problem if the park closed. I would still be at risk, which is not what was intended. My income and the income of most people in a manufactured home is such that we really can't afford to relocate our home. You're talking about thousands of dollars. You can't hook it up like some people think to your car and take it away. It just can't be done. And what would happen is I would probably have to go into subsidized housing. Now, that's not my intent. I'm used to paying my own way, and I don't want to be a burden to the state. Especially now with our economic position, I don't want to. I don't wish to go into subsidized housing, but I also don't want to have somebody else, you know, pay. What we really want to do is pay our own way, okay, and be like every other homeowner, you know, doing our part. And so with it not working this way right now, we tried to come up with something for 2 years that would make it work, and we haven't been able to do that. This, what we're proposing right now with this amendment, would be cost-effective because it would be the least expensive way of doing it, and the funds would be there then that you could use for that, and that's something I think is real important to our state right now, is something that's cost-effective. But most of all, it would actually cover all the manufactured homeowners in the state of Minnesota, which was the original intent and purpose of the law that was passed in 2007. So I would strongly urge you to pass this amendment to the bill so that everybody would be covered. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Boone. Is there any questions?
Mr.
Senator Fischbach?
Oh, I could. You know what? I have questions for Senator Tomasoni.
Okay.
Never mind. I'll wait.
We'll wait till the testimony is done. Could you?
My name is Paul Ruby. Am I speaking loud enough?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good mic. I have a couple of hearing aids, and I have a very loud voice, so sometimes I don't even need it. If I talk too loud, just whistle or something, let me know. Okay. My name is Paul Ruby. I live in Rolling Hills Mobile Home Park. I'm vice president of APEC. I'm also president of the Rolling Hills Resident Association, which we started about a year and a half ago. This is interesting. Tonight we come in here and this morning we were talking about housing, and the group before us is talking about it too. These foreclosures are getting to be something, aren't they? Everybody's got this housing problem. I can't stress enough about how important this mobile home housing is. Our attorney said we have 50,000 home people we have 50,000 families in Minnesota that are living in mobile homes. These are the amount of families. This is about 180,000 people. This is about 4% of the population. This is very, very important. Now, one of the problems with this program is that it never, you know, it's a beautiful program. The trust fund, you wrote it, everything is so good with it. It's great. The problem is the administration, the picking up the money. The money is the problem, okay? How it was to be funded. And I think part of the problem is it's how when the owners send out the notices. Now, many of the owners, you know, they took the envelopes and put them in the drawers. I don't think they ever even got out there. But even the ones that did, they would write out letters to the park people. And if I can, I'll just read you a letter. It won't take long. It'll kind of give you a little ambiguity when you hear this. In 2007, the Minnesota legislature passed a law creating the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund. The purpose of the fund is to provide each resident with a source of money to cover relocation expenses or cash to buy their home if their community were to close. Here's where the ambiguity becomes. We want to be clear. Rolling Hills of Maplewood is not closing. However, state law requires us to notify you about the existence of the fund and to collect the $12 fee on behalf of the state of Minnesota. New paragraph. Under the law, each resident is required to pay the annual fee by August 15th to Rolling Hills of Maplewood. We will forward the check equal to the amount collection from all residents to the state of Minnesota by September 15th. Please understand, if you do not pay the fee, you will not be eligible to receive compensation from the fund. If the Manufactured Home Park closes, residents who paid the fee would be entitled to relocation expenses to move their home or cash compensation. Please pay with a separate check of $12, et cetera. If your rent is not going to be paid by the 15th, you still need to pay the fee by the 15th. Once again, Rolling Hills of Maplewood is not closing. We're only doing our part to comply with the state law with providing you with this information. We value you as a resident and look forward to serving you for the long term. So, see, people see this and they say, do we have to pay it or don't we have to pay it? Now, you have people in the park here that we have about in our park. We have about 50% of the park is single wides and 50% are double wides. Now, a lot of these single wides are seniors that have been there for 20 years, and over 20 years, a lot of them, because they've been there with the previous owner of the park, which, by the way, has been sold in the last 4 years to an investment company out of California, which is raising the rent sky high, which is another whole issue. We won't get into that. But anyway, what is happening here is they're sending these letters out, and you see, the way it works is that they've trusted these people for so many years, they just think, well, maybe we don't have to pay that $12. What they don't realize is if anything happens, they're out. They really are out. And so they trust the old owners. You can't trust, you know, you have to be able to, they need that fund. So this trust fund is very, very important. And you know, it's better we get this trust fund through so everybody pays it. Otherwise, you know, where are we going to go? Maybe they're going to have to be subsidized by you. You know, it's possible. And me. And but anyway, I thank you for your time, and it's been an honor speaking with you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ruby. Is there any questions for him?
Any questions we can answer?
I have one question, and I think it's to Justin, and that is, has any state agency made any effort to collect this money?
Right now, it's been just voluntary. The park owners are collecting it and handing it in. Right now, no state agency has made an effort to collect the money at all.
Thank you. Senator Fishbach?
Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Bell is probably the appropriate person to direct my questions at. I'm just wondering, I guess, why, and this may go back to 07 and why it was written this way, but my understanding on page 2, line 15, it says homeowner, and it's this, the language that was struck. So this is the language that's leaving.
I didn't get a copy of the actual amendment either, so I'll follow what you're saying.
I think Senator Tomasoni has one. He's just helpful today, aren't you, Senator Tomasoni? But it says owners of manufactured homes who rent lots in a manufactured home park shall. So it says they shall make these payments. So I guess that to me says they're breaking the law because they're not doing it. So why do we now have to change it? I mean, it's, I guess, in that shell makes it, puts the burden on them, and we have to change the whole program because they're not following the law.
Well, there's two issues. One is that what Mr. Rubio is speaking to is that often when it's presented to homeowners, it's presented as the law says that you have to do this to protect you in case of closing, but we're not closing. So let me just make clear that we're not closing. And that happens pretty regularly. The other issue is that there are hundreds of parks across the state that aren't providing this information to residents as they're supposed to under current law. So I speak to residents weekly on our legal hotline of people who have no idea what the trust fund is. We go into communities and ask people if they've paid into the trust fund, and they have no idea what the trust fund is. No one's ever spoke to them. They haven't gotten any information as they're supposed to from the park owners. Even in Mr. Ruby's park, when we go out and to park meetings and we say, who's paid into the trust fund, one half of the room will raise their hand and the other half won't. And it's not spread throughout the park. It's sections of the park that didn't get any notices.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, Mr. Bell, so basically what we're doing is they were supposed to write a check by whatever it was, the 15th of some month,
right,
for $12.
Yes.
Right.
And now it is going to be added to their rent $1 a month.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, the idea would be that the park owners would be assessed up front for the fee for every licensed lot, and then it would be recollected through their rent, so that everything would be collected up front, and then they would be allowed to recapture it through adding a dollar a month to their rent, or if they should decide to collect it all at once, it would be up to the park owners.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bell,
Senator Fischbach,
why not just do it at the, you know, allow the park owners to collect the $1 and then pay at the end of the whatever, you know, once they've collected it?
As long as it was actually being collected, Senator Fischbach, as long as it was actually being collected, that's an idea that we have on the table as well. Our thought being that if it wasn't being collected all up front, there's really not. Having someone else go after to enforce the collection of $12 isn't always very feasible, but if it's the collection for an entire park, that might be something that's enforceable and a little bit more feasible.
Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bell, I guess. But you could go after them after the date. You know, let's just use the regular year because all the dates get mixed up. But if you allowed them to pay on December 31st for the entire year, for the 12 months for every owner in the park, so that they had collected it and then paid it, instead of having them pay it up front, wouldn't that be an easier way for the park owners to deal with it, since they're not having to upfront all the money?
Absolutely,
Mr.
And that's a possibility, Senator Fischbach, that we have brought up with little response.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Tomasoni,
Senator Fischbach, not everybody agrees with this bill, just so you know. So, like I said, it's a really hard $12 to collect. You can't believe it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I am aware of the concerns, and that's why I'm just trying to, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, figure out.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
You know, because it seems like that upfront, you know, they have to, and it's, we're talking about $12, but you know, how many times, however many owners in your park are, and that's not it's not necessarily small change.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach,
Mr. Bell,
if collecting the money along with rent $1 a month and paying at the end of the fiscal year in is an acceptable compromise, I think that we would be able to solve this problem right now.
Senator Tomasoni, is there anybody else to speak in favor of this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is Hannah Garcia. She's an organizer with All Parks Alliance for Change, and she would like to testify to the racial disparities under collecting under the current fund.
Thank you.
Good morning. I just wanted to make
point. Say your name for the record?
Absolutely. Hannah Garcia.
Thank you.
So I wanted to make the point that anytime there's a system where people are being excluded, people of color are often disproportionately impacted. Our research shows that people of color are more likely to be displaced by a park closing, yet less likely to be covered under the current trust fund. Statewide, more than 10% of manufactured home park residents are people of color. Taking this fact into consideration, it's disturbing to learn that 54% of park residents displaced due to a park closing are people of color. According to the research that we've done in manufactured home neighborhoods in central Minnesota, as well as the north and south metro areas, there's a majority of people of color who are being denied the right to participate into the trust fund, often because of language barriers and lack of adequate notification. So the proposed changes that we're discussing right now would resolve these racial inequities and ensure that all of Minnesota's manufactured homeowners are protected in the event of a park closing.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. There's a Mr. Mark Bruner that is asked to testify from the Manufactured Housing Association.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Bruner. I'm the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Modular Housing Association, and we're sort of the umbrella organization that represents the factory-built housing industry in Minnesota. There are eight plants that a couple of years ago when the housing market was a little stronger built about 4,000 homes. We manufactured homes are the largest source of unsubsidized affordable housing in the state of Minnesota. There are about 900 and some licensed manufactured home parks in the state, and and many of those are our members. We probably represent about 75 or 80% of all of the home sites, so those licensed home sites, although a lot of the smaller manufactured home parks aren't members of our association. We have real concerns with the bill as it's been amended. In 2007, we did work with AIPAC and the advocates to come up with the trust fund. Now, you know, manufactured home park closings are not significant in number. Obviously, when they happen, they impact homeowners and families. This isn't something that's causing great alarm or concern in terms of a drain on the trust fund. The trust fund is solvent. What we agreed to in 2007 was a system that essentially required the residents to pay $12, the homeowners $12, into the trust fund. The manufactured home park owners would collect the fee and mail it into the state. And the owners of the manufactured home parks are required to complete a form that they send in outlining who actually paid and who didn't. And now statistically, or looking at the numbers that have been generated by the state of Minnesota, of those manufactured home parks that did attempt to collect, it's about 50% of the residents that they've asked to pay into the fund have declined to pay their $12. So the owners then send in a list to the state, and it of those that paid and that those declined. What the bill now would do is place essentially the burden of paying the $12 on the owners of the manufactured home parks. And the fund was set up, if you will, as in a sort of an insurance policy that where the residents were to pay in and have some skin in the game, if you will, in terms of the $12 a year you've paid in. If you don't pay in, you're not covered. If you don't pay your personal property taxes to the county, you're not covered. Those were a couple of the provisions that were put in to add a little teeth. The owners of the manufactured home parks, if there is a closing, are required to put in, I contribute, I believe it's like up to $6,000 per home. And so everybody has got some skin in the game. What the bill does is require then that the state would bill the manufactured home park owners $12 times the number of home sites they have. A couple issues just from the get-go are that there really is no accurate source to bill from for the state of Minnesota to send this invoice. The way the Department of Health and counties license manufactured home parks is that you could have a license that, for example, is for a property that has 200 licensed home sites. Now, within that license, you may have some seasonal RV or campsite lots or rentals. Now, those structures are not covered by the trust fund, and that could change from year to year. You know, there may be 15 seasonal structures in a property this year, maybe 10 next year. So what would happen is the owner of the property would get this statement that says you owe 12 times the 200 when, in fact, they don't, A, necessarily have 200 manufactured homes there, B, even if they have 200 home sites, you know, 10-15% of those home sites may be vacant. So you're going to have a real disconnect when an owner gets a statement that they're responsible for paying, and it doesn't match with the actual number of homes that they have in their community. Another thing the bill would do is require that the dollar that the manufactured home park owner would be able to charge the residents, if you will, per month for this fee, be clearly labeled. It's not clear where that would be clearly labeled. Most of these owners don't provide monthly rent statements. I mean, so essentially now, if they want to collect the dollar, they're going to have to generate a statement every month that, you know, piece of paper, you owe us a dollar in addition to your rent that we can accumulate up to the $12 and then mail it in. I mean, you know, that if you have a 200 site manufactured home community, doing that every month is, you know, an additional nearly 2,000 entries, if you will, to your accounting system that you're going to have to keep track of each dollar each month that you're collecting. And so there, you know, really believe that there needs to be some more work done in terms of the whole system. I mean, we certainly don't support the idea of us having to pay the $12 if, in fact, the $12 was to be a resident fee. But just from a managerial standpoint in the fund, I don't see how it will work in terms of invoices going out for home sites that may not have manufactured homes. You have licensed manufactured home parks in the state, the larger counties do their own licensing. Some of the cities do their own licensing. You have the city of Bloomington, for example, that does its own licensing. You have Hennepin County. There's no central source, or there's no one location of a master list that anyone could work from to even generate these invoices. That doesn't exist today.
Mr. Bruner, do you have a solution to the problem?
Well, we've actually come up with a couple of solutions. We just amended the bill, so the one solution that we had agreed to has just gone away in terms of using the CRP money that otherwise would go to the homeowners, you know, subtracting $12 from what the refund would be as a way to cover them, and then use for those that didn't apply for the CRP money, if you will, and those that may not qualify, we would have essentially moved over the funds to the trust fund. You know, that created issues. Obviously, in a time of a shortfall, the money would have to come from the general fund. There is no dedicated fund that Department of Revenue has for the CRP program. Last year, we had a solution that, again, generated some opposition, which was to put the $12 on the personal property tax statement that each resident or homeowner receives in a manufactured home park from the counties each year. The idea was that you'd have your property taxes, you'd have the $12 listed, and that's what you would send in. The requirement right now is that if to be covered by the fund, you have to be current on your personal property taxes. So if you don't pay those and the $12, you know, that there was a track record. There were issues the counties had in terms of reprogramming computers to add the $12 to the statement. So we actually have looked at other alternatives. And it's just that, you know, what we're presented with today as a concept, we have real issues with in terms of being responsible as owners for the $12.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I just wanted to respond really quickly to a couple of the points that Mr. Bruner made. There's always an issue of having an accurate list of manufactured home parks in Minnesota. There is not one good list from an agency. Generally, you have to start with the Department of Health's licensing list and then in turn work with municipalities and counties. APAC has done that before. We're happy to offer guidance. The Minnesota Housing Preservation Project has a list on their website, which we've shared with MMB. It's a pretty good list to start from. It's fairly comprehensive. We started with the Department of Health list and then used counties and municipalities on top of that. Second of all, the bill language actually does allow for any park owner to deduct RVs or any other non-eligible occupied lots in their park from the payment that they send in from the invoicing. And as far as renting, having to give a $1 rent increase when you don't invoice every month for rent, just a notice one time saying that starting on this date, your rent would be raised $1 to participate with the Minnesota Manufactured Relocation Trust Fund would be sufficient. And the comparisons of this to an insurance program is troublesome, because if there was an insurance program that missing one premium meant you were never allowed to be eligible again for the rest of your life for the insurance, it would be pretty devastating. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Is there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, let me make a suggestion, because
Senator Tomasoni?
It sounds like both sides want to solve the problem. We just don't exactly know how to do it so that both sides can agree to it. So how about if I move this bill without recommendation and it would go to the Finance Committee, and in the meantime, these advocates can work something out that they both can live with that will actually be a mechanism that works for everybody, and hopefully we can go from there.
Senator Tomasoni moves the bill without recommendation. Is there any questions, Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, can I just ask one question about page 3? And there's language added, the court shall award a prevailing plaintiff reasonable.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. It's page 3.
Okay.
And it awards court fees. And I'm wondering why that was added. What's the impetus for that?
Mr. Bell.
I speak to that, Mr. Chair. Senator Fischbach, there's been questions about the enforcement mechanism. So who's going to enforce a park that doesn't pay? If a park gets an invoice from the state under this proposal, if it becomes law, who's going to make them pay? Are we going to make revenue recapture? And that language was added so that the current language allows for a private right of action. And if we were allowed to recapture attorney's costs and court costs along with that, any individual or organization such as APAC or Legal Aid could actually file a motion on behalf of somebody and enforce it in court.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Bell, this says only a plaintiff, so that if a defendant wins, he cannot be awarded these costs, he or she.
Mr. Chair, Bell. Senator Fischbach, that's correct under the current language, yes.
Senator Fischbach? Mr. Chair, Mr. Bell, don't you think that it would be a little more fair that it would just be the prevailing litigant?
We would certainly be open to changing that language to having whoever the prevailing litigant wants. Yes, Senator Fischbach.
Is there any other questions?
Do you want to change that, Senator Fischbach?
Mr. Chair, if it would be prevailing party. Litigant.
Prevailing party.
Prevailing party, whatever works there. But that would be removing the plaintiff and adding the other party.
Senator.
Party.
Be on line, it'd be page 3.
Mr. Chair, on page 3, line 10, delete plaintiff and insert party.
Insert party. Senator Fischbach moves to amend Senate File 1269 on page 3, line 310, to remove, delete plaintiff and add party. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Bill passes. Senator Tomasoni has moved that we move this to the Finance Committee without recommendation.
As amended, Mr. Chair.
As amended. Sorry. Thanks. Is there any other discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Bill passes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator
Before
Martin.
Mr. Bell and Mr. Bruner leave, I just wondered, I heard there are about 900 parks right now. Are there any new ones being put up these days?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Mr. Bruner?
Okay.
Senator Bell?
Because the reason I asked is that this is when awkward, always going to be a difficult situation, because you have two owners here, the owner of the home and also a separate owner of the land underneath it. And the idea, I mean, this is devastating for the families when a park closes. And I know we've been working for years to try and get some sort of either right of first refusal or some way that the homeowners can purchase the park when they're closing down. I just wondered, are you guys talking regularly about trying to find a bigger fix so that, because when a park closes, the people lose their entire assets, their entire life savings, and there's no place they can move many of them to, at least in the metro area. And I just wonder the status. Is there anything?
Well, Senator.
Mr. Bruner.
Yes. In current law, if a manufactured home park is closing, the residents have a right of first refusal to purchase the property. Beyond that, in terms of a closing, you know, we've talked about there hasn't been legislation that might, for example, require some type of alternative location for the homes that are being displaced within a city. We're certainly interested in always looking at opportunities to develop new manufactured home parks so that there would be, you know, additional locations for someone to relocate to if there is a closure.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, that might be the type of direction we might want to go in a year or so, and that is to require that for local governments. I mean, often I know one in the western suburbs was talking about closing down a park for a road. I remember they were saying they couldn't move ball field, but they could shut down some people's homes. That if we were going to, local governments were going to rezone or allow this to happen, that they'd have to provide equal amount of land in another place that they could move within a 3 or 5 mile radius or something. But I think that would be worth exploring.
Mr. Bruner?
Just on this issue in terms of solutions, I believe it was just last week the governor of Utah signed a bill that the legislature passed requiring municipalities, or at least enabling them, to use tax increment money from the development, you know, from the increase in tax revenue to offset the relocation costs and any of the hardships from the incurred by those being displaced. So I think there are, you know, options that we could look at.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Marty. I was just putting a couple things together today, and that is that since land trusts can't pay for the housing, and the housing are owned, it seems like an ideal situation for a land trust to get involved in this kind of manufacturing for affordable housing. And I'm not sure if that's something we can move on, but it just seems like an alternative to no new parks being built. Is there? Let's see. I'm sorry. We're done with that bill, and we're moving on to the next one, which is Senate File 969.
This me again?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni, you are presenting for Senator Dibble, and I'm sure you'll do a great job.
Oh.
Senator Tomasoni?
You know, I think Senator Laurie should be doing this because he has more hair like Senator Dibble does, and looks more like him. But
why I'm not on?
I don't know why you aren't.
I'll support you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll give a quick introduction of the bill, and then I'll let the people who are at the table here tell you what's going on here. But Senate File 969 is about Youth Moving Forward concept bill, and on any given night in Minnesota, there are 1,800 unaccompanied homeless youth. Senate File 969 outlines strategy for prevention and intervention to assure youth who are aging out of our own state system do not end up homeless and support a safety net for those youth who do become homeless. So today here in committee, this committee will hear how, taken together, improving systems for youth aging out of our foster care systems and providing base funding for a safety net of supports can position Minnesota to move toward ending youth homelessness and, perhaps more importantly for today, provide each youth with the targeted investment they need to become the fully contributing adults they seek in our communities. You want to go first?
Sure.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
members of the committee.
Could you move the mic a little bit closer, please? And
sure. My name is Kirsten Anderson Stembridge. I'm with Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. We thank you for the invitation to hear this important bill that includes prevention and intervention measures to combat and position Minnesota to move towards ending youth homelessness. The bill before you includes an agenda created and supported by advocates, youth-serving organizations across the state who are committed to supporting youth so they can build their strengths, gain skills and direction, and receive targeted investments so they can go on to achieve their short and long-term dreams and contribute to their talents to community life. A coalition of experts, youth, county and state staff, homeless youth service providers, out-of-home placement providers, and other supportive parties built this agenda for 2009 to reflect the most urgent priorities for youth. This coming together of so many parties is a reflection of the will of communities statewide, an affirmation made clear in countless educational, fundraising, and advocacy events sponsored by youth and supporters throughout the state. Just to provide a bit of history, in 2007, this body wisely chose to invest $1 million in the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, supporting a continuum of services for communities statewide to meet the needs of youth. This targeted investment served 7,067 youth statewide. During the 2008 session, you took steps to hold the foster care system accountable for youth, for working with youth to develop the skills necessary for independent living by requiring court reviews of progress towards independent living plans. In 2009, we come before you to encourage an agenda that assures all youth who age out of foster care receive medical coverage up to the age of 21, invites youth who run from care after the age of 15 or who age out of care to receive services up to the age of 21, preserves the assets that youth retain while in care as they age out, and invests in the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, a continuum of services for homeless youth that includes street outreach, drop-in centers, shelter, and transitional living programs. We present this agenda as a whole strategy for assuring that our children, the 600 young people that age out of care each year, and the 1,800 youth who are homeless on any given night in the state of Minnesota, have the stability, opportunity, and connection they need for successful transitions into adulthood. Just one brief word about Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. We provide 23 areas of service across the state of Minnesota. So we have a pretty good understanding of some of the challenges that we're facing to fund these services. And we've made this our priority because we see that there lacks a coherent public strategy to support these most vulnerable young people. And we also have a deep understanding of the targeted investment that we're able to then yield wonderful results from when we are able to invest in our young people. Finally, just to provide a bit of context, today we'll focus most of the testimony on the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, as the other provisions of this bill have been heard in other committees. And we'll ask that you pass Senate File 969 out of this committee as the vehicle for the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act appropriations to move through the rest of the legislative cycle.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dr. Barry Cohen. I'm the executive director of Rainbow Research in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We're a nonprofit research firm that's been in business for 35 years now and has done a lot of evaluation research work for the state. We've been providing technical assistance to the Department of Human Services in the evaluation of 19 programs throughout Minnesota funded under the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. And these programs include street outreach, drop-in centers, emergency shelters, transitional living programs that serve some of the 1,800 youth who on any given night are homeless in Minnesota. And what I'd like to do this morning is present to you preliminary findings from 18 focus groups with approximately 120 youth who participated, and from the analysis of the exit surveys that each of the participants completed. I should tell you that data collection just was completed this week. So my report to you is today is based on completed surveys of about half the youth, 58 of them, and notes from 16 of the 18 groups that were conducted. And so what I'd like to talk about this morning is the findings to date that I do believe point to a set of programs that are significantly beneficial to homeless and runaway youth that they serve. First, I'd like to talk about some of the things that youth told us that they learned in the programs. Clearly, most of the young people in these programs learned how to access services that are critical to their health, their safety, and their well-being. So, for example, when we asked them what they learned through the program, 65% of you said they learned where to go in a medical emergency, and 78% said they knew where to go for health care. 78% of them said that they learned how to use public transit, how to access food shelves, or where they could get a free meal. Let's see. Almost 90% of the youth said they had learned where to go for a safe place to stay. How have these programs affected the relationships of these young people? Well, we know from research done over the last 20 years how important it is for young people to have a caring adult in their life and the impact that has on their educational achievement, on health and safety, on social and emotional development, and and the research has shown that having a caring adult in their lives makes a very large difference. What did the youth tell us about their experience with relationships? 89% of the youth whose surveys we analyzed said they had made a connection through the program with an adult who cares about them. And 70% said they had found a mentor whose advice that they trust. There's also a large body of literature examining the importance of attachment to parents and peers as it relates to life satisfaction, mental health, and self-esteem in the future. And compared to how things were before they came to the program, 72% of the young people reported that their relationship with parents, legal guardians, or caregivers was better or a lot better than it was before they joined the program. 74% reported that their relationship with their brothers or sisters was better or a lot better. Now, we know that homeless youth are quite vulnerable and at risk for becoming involved in crime, delinquency, and other behaviors that jeopardize their health and their safety and the health and safety and property of others. And we also know that once they're involved in the criminal justice system, the cost to the community for dealing with them becomes many times more expensive than the support they receive through community-based programs. Well, the proportion of youth who said they were involved in risky or criminal behavior after they became involved in the program is relatively small. So depending on the behavior, and there's a long list of them, 80 to 90% did not become involved in serious trouble or put themselves at risk. And when we talk to the youth, other than those who were involved in street outreach, we asked them how much better were things now compared to how they were before they came into the program. 77% of these young people told us that they were staying out of trouble with the law more so than they were able to before they were involved in the program. Two-thirds reported that their school attendance was better or a lot better than it was before they had became involved with the program. And 78% reported that things were a lot better or better in terms of having a legal source of income, be it employment, or some form of public assistance. So in short, based on the self-report of the young people, the programs are getting the youth who participate back on track, helping them to stay out of trouble, helping them to attend school, to work or collect benefits. And I'll close with what the youth told us in the focus groups about the two or three ways they most benefited from being involved in these programs funded under the Act. To name a few, they often mentioned food, shelter, housing, jobs, and help with school. These are the kinds of outcomes we were looking for. They're worthwhile and important. And one theme that came through loud and strong across the different focus groups, consistently mentioned in every one that we looked at so far, is the quality of the relationship that the youth have with the staff and the support they receive from the staff of these programs. In the words of one of the youth who participated in a program in Duluth, who was talking about the benefits of being a participant, he had to say, "This is about having someone who cares, knowing they won't give up, knowing they won't dump you off." So with that, I'll say thank you for your attention this morning. The Homeless and Runaway Youth Programs and our evaluation appear to us from the preliminary findings to be making important differences in the lives of these young people. We look forward to sharing with you a more definitive report with complete data from all the sites and a thorough analysis of the focus group findings when we finish our report in late April. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Is sure. there any questions? Seeing none. Do you want to move on?
Are we done with testifiers? We're going to get some more testifiers.
We've got a couple more testifiers.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I need to apologize up front. I woke up yesterday and I was losing my voice. So I'll try to get through this as best I can. My name is Andrea Simonette, and I am the director of Catholic Charities Hope Street Programs for Runaway and Homeless Youth. We are current recipients of the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act funding, which assists us in providing outreach, shelter, and housing services to homeless youth in crisis. In our current economic climate, our ability to raise supplemental funds through charitable contributions has been very difficult and challenging. The flexible funding from the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act has provided some stability for our programs and has helped us continue to deliver quality services to youth in crisis. We are seeing several concerning trends in our programs. Every night our shelter is packed full. In 2008, we had over 100% utilization of our shelter beds, and that was because we slept youth on our couches. We turned away almost 1,000 youth from shelter who were otherwise eligible for services. On a typical day, we'll have an open bed in the morning. Generally, within 1 or 2 hours, that bed is filled up. And then we field 7, 8, 9, 10 phone calls all day long telling youth that bed is filled. But generally, within an hour, our open beds are filled up. Of particular concern is the disturbing trend that we see in regards to youth who are aging out of care and into homelessness. Over half of the youth that we served in 2008 had an out-of-home placement after the age of 14. 15% of the referrals that we received last quarter alone were from social workers who were struggling to try to find shelter for a youth that was still in their care and were aging out. I'm in a particularly unique position to witness firsthand the realities of youth aging out of care and into homelessness. And this is because our homeless shelter is located in the same building as St. Joseph's Home for Children, which has several residential treatment units for youth who are in care. Just a long hallway separates the St. Joe's residential units from the Hope Street homeless youth programs. When thinking about speaking with you today, I thought of many stories that I could tell to illustrate the concerning reality of impending homelessness on youth in care. But I would like to tell you one particular story, and that is of Jasmine on her 18th birthday. Jasmine had been in and out of home placements almost all of her life and was a ward of the state and was in placement for her entire 17th year. As with all youth celebrating birthdays at St. Joe's Home for Children, there was a party, a cake was ordered, birthday presents were given, and the morning celebration was nice, except for what followed, which was in the afternoon having to pack up her bags and move her right down the hallway into the homeless youth program, which was to be her new home. This story of Jasmine's is not an exaggerated one, and it is not unique. Youth enter all of our programs, whether it's drop-in centers or on the streets with outreach workers or shelters, from many different counties, many different facilities, and in many different ways. What is common among all those stories is the need for support, the incredible resiliency of the youth that we see and that we serve, and their ability to be wonderfully productive adults if given targeted investment in their moments of need. Thank you.
Is there any questions? The next testifier.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Uleski Basarte. First, I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to be here with you all. Good morning. I had to wake up pretty early, so I know you guys did too. I come from an avid readers, lovers of words, and just a basic thirst for knowledge. I've always wanted to start my own business ever since I was young. And growing up, I think that I really solidified that when I didn't find any resources in my community to help me do that. So now my plan is to own my own community resource center. And When I first experienced homelessness at the age of 17, I didn't know if any of my dreams were going to be possible. Like, where was I going to go from there? You know, I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have any homeless friends to show me the ropes or anything. I didn't really know anything about that life. And it was frustrating. At the start, I had two jobs, and I had to leave both of them because of the constant moving and whatnot. It was just not possible for me to keep up. And I kept enrolling in school, but, you know, having to move around and not knowing where you're going to be at, you don't really get your homework done, and it's not really a priority because you have to worry about where you're going to sleep and what you're going to eat, you know. And so it was really frustrating. It's really easy to lose hope in those situations. And I remember I just got tired of bouncing around not knowing where to go. So I went to a hospital because I knew they'd have some information. They usually do. And I found a shelter program. There was no open beds at first at all in the Twin Cities. There are about five of youth shelters in Minneapolis and probably like two in St. Paul. So all of them were filled, all of the beds. I slept on a couch for a couple of months. And when I did get a bed, I was really grateful for it, of course. You know, you're grateful for the little things that you take for granted. And I think that had it not been for these programs, I don't know where I would have been, you know. I probably would have gave up thinking it was too hard. And I could honestly say that I might have been one less person today, you know. But because of these programs, I can say that I'm one more, you know, who will be successful and, you know, make it out of the situation. And I have really good ACT scores. I'm pretty excited about that. So I can go to the college that I want to go to and not just settle for any old college that'll take me. And when I didn't think that I could make it, I know that I turned to these programs, the drop-in centers, because I didn't have anywhere else to go. And I turned to the shelters, and I had therapists to help me along the way, like, oh, it's going to be okay, kind of reaffirming things I already knew. I'm pretty intelligent. And I know that now these programs need help, and they're turning to you guys. And I'm just so appreciating that the fact that you're here listening to us and giving us the chance to say how we feel instead of just passing it off. I know that right now I'm in a shelter at Avenues for Homeless Youth, and being there has really helped me a lot. Hopefully, I won't have to be in this situation anymore. I am working, currently in hot pursuit of a second job, going to school, and hopefully off to college next fall. And I just would like to thank you all and hope that you continue to support these programs so that other young youth like me will have the opportunity to do as much as I feel I'm doing right now. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Patharte. Yes. Is that right? I'm sorry. I'm glad to hear that you've got great ACT scores. I'm just wondering if, as a daughter that's getting ready to looking at college next year as well. Did the shelters help you get your homework done, keep you active in school, et cetera?
It really made it a lot easier for me to get school done because I didn't have to worry about where I was going to stay. And the shelter that I'm at now, it's a requirement that you are in school or working. So they really do push you to be active, and they're all on you, like, so when are you going to school, and what are you doing, and how's your homework coming? Every 5 minutes, but it's really a good motivation, though, to stay on top of my stuff.
Good. Any Senator Laurie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to thank Ms.
Patharte.
Thank you for getting up early and coming and telling us your story. I mean, these are so critical. I did carry last year the Ready to Launch package, which was three provisions, one of which we did get passed, which was the court planning process for kids about to age out of the system, and we really hope to start seeing some good results from that. And, you know, these youth, they are our kids. They're our kids. They have no other parents to go to. And I think anybody who's got teen kids and that are aging out of our homes, we know they're going to need support as they move forward into adulthood. It is a painfully difficult transition from youth into adulthood, and that's no different for foster youth than it is for any other youth. So these services are just so critical. The other piece we're working on, and I'd just like to share one other story, one other success story, that we had the extending health care eligibility to age 21 without barriers up in the health committee earlier, and we heard it in the budget side as well, and we're going to continue to work on that. It was David Anderson, and he's now in the National Guard and no longer able to come and tell us his story, but it is one that really was powerful to help us understand, again, the potential and the resilience of these youth, but they're going to need somebody to reach out to them and help them access those services that make sure that they're able to realize that potential and remain resilient. And so I thank you for bringing these provisions forward and hope that we can keep them moving forward through the legislative process.
And if I could,
Ms. Buffett,
I just wanted to reinforce the statement that this problem is continuous. It's prevalent, and it's a real problem. Like, most of the young people you see passing on the street, about half of them are probably have some experience with homelessness. And I know that I did testify once before, and a senator who shall remain nameless sort of seemed a little, like, irritated, like, why are you guys still here? Because there's still the problem. You know, the problem is still here, so we will still be here. So, yeah.
Thank you. Another testifier?
Good morning. My name is Crystal Davis, and I'm with Safe Zone. And I've been in their transitional living program for almost a year now. But before that, I was couch hopping for a year and a half. I moved out because I couldn't get along with my mom. And during the time I was homeless, I moved about 7 times. And each time I moved, I'd get rid of more and more clothes, so I didn't have to lug around as much stuff with me. And by the time I got into the program, I only had, like, 1 bag with me. And during the time I was homeless, I didn't have any money, so I dropped out of school so I could work. And about a year after I was homeless, I heard about Safe Zone through a street worker. She had came to my school, and she told me some of the services they offered, like they could help me with housing, and they could help me with meals and clothing. And, like, due to my situation, I'd come down there, like, almost every day just to eat so I wouldn't go to bed hungry at night. And learning about Safe Zone changed my life for the better, because at the time I heard about them, I was finna give up or whatever. And then, because I felt like I was running out of resources, and then Safe Zone came along. And a few months after I started going to Safe Zone, I got accepted into their transitional living program. And since I've been in the program, I've learned how to manage my finances, and that's lifted a lot of stress off my shoulders, because I no longer have to worry about where I'm going to lay my head at night. I don't have to sit and call people like, can I come over? Can I stay the night for a few nights or whatever? And, like, right now I'm back in school. Next month I will have my diploma, and I'm working full-time right now. And I have 2 jobs, a full-time and a part-time, and they're going pretty good. And in the fall I plan to go to college or whatever, because I want to be a case manager, because I plan to help people like other people have helped me.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Senator Tomasoni, I noticed there's a jobs component in this bill. Is there just slip of there? Or?
This is Senator Dibble's bill. So.
Oh.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. You might have slipped something in there. Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment, an A1 amendment, but I don't think I'm going to need it, because it looks to me like
understand.
Would like to delete sections 1, 3, 4, and 6 of the bill. Maybe you want to explain that.
Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee. Yeah, we're seeking to delete out all the sections that actually Senator Lurie spoke to earlier. It's part of the Ready to Launch package. These are provisions that are moving in other vehicles. And so our intent for this morning was simply to use this as an opportunity to talk about the whole agenda for youth aging out of care and youth experiencing homelessness, and then to allow Senate File 969 to be the vehicle for the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act appropriation.
For the record, can we get the sections that you wish to be deleted?
Mr. Chair, members, those are sections 1, 3, 4, and 6. Detached.
Yeah. 1 through 4 and
1, 3, 6. Well, the only thing left is the appropriation.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni moves to delete sections 1, 3, 4, and 6. Is there any discussion? Did I miss that?
Hold it. 1, 3, and 4.
1, 3, okay. 1, 3, okay. Thank you.
1, 3, 4, not 6.
1, 3, 4, okay. Thank you. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed? Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate File 969 be passed and moved on.
As amended.
Excuse me. Thank you. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Thank you. I have a couple bills to present, so do you have to go? Senator Marty, do you have time to chair?
Sure, I can chair.
I wasn't sure. Senator Tomasoni's been working awfully hard.
Yeah.
Tomasoni, work hard.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1166, and it is an act for, related to human services, changing the ability for group residential housing and amending a couple of statutes that will allow folks that are in group housing to earn a little more money before they are losing their housing.
Do you have an A1 technical amendment as well?
There's an A1 technical amendment coming out too. Thank you.
So Kiyosh moves A1 amendment. Any discussion from the member of the committee? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Senator Marty, I'm going to let the testifiers speak, and
Ms.
I think
Tendrick,
that'll...
Welcome to the committee.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kathy Tenbrook. I am the coordinator to end homelessness for the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County. As many of you know, we have a community plan to end homelessness in Minneapolis and Hennepin County called Heading Home Hennepin. We are 2 years into our implementation. We have learned a great deal about the efforts that have been most effective and some of the challenges and barriers that individuals and families we are serving are facing. Two major goals of Heading Home Hennepin are to assist people in accessing safe and stable housing and to build families and individuals' abilities to support themselves whenever possible. Group residential housing, or GRH, has been an enormously valuable tool for housing people with disabilities. It has, in my estimation, been one of the best tools in our toolbox for housing people experiencing homelessness who are also struggling with mental health issues or other disabling conditions.
However, after hearing from many of our housing partners, we've realized that while GRH is critically important, it does not provide any incentive for someone to move off of the program and into employment. Many participants in these housing programs have talked about their desire to return to work in the future. Many could benefit from more incentives and transition options to return to work. We'd like to see their time in GRH, in the GRH program, as an opportunity to get stable and to get healthy, to get some additional training or education to prepare them for better jobs in the future, or if their disability is a permanent one, time to assist them in receiving supplemental security income, or SSI. Here's just a quick hypothetical example to illustrate some of the part of the issue and the purpose of this legislation. Currently, let's say that someone is housed through the GRH program because of an untreated mental illness. They're eligible for general assistance because they're unable to work. This makes them eligible for GRH, and therefore they get housed. After being housed, they receive regular mental health services and get on appropriate medications. With their illness stabilized, they have the desire to begin to do at least some work in the community. They may not be quite ready to work full-time or to go off on their own completely, but they would like to begin to do part-time work and eventually be able to support themselves. Currently, there is a built-in disincentive in the GRH program for them to work their way off of the program. If they begin to work and make as little as $300 per month, they will no longer be eligible for general assistance, which will make them ineligible for group residential housing, which will make them lose their housing. At $300 a month, I think we can all agree that's not quite enough yet to be able to support themselves. Our intent is to encourage self-support, but it's really hard to encourage somebody to do that when there's such a risk involved. This legislation would allow this individual to work for 12 months or until they reach the income eligibility limit for group residential housing, which is $776, before they would lose their housing. So this would basically buy them time to work, build up their ability to support themselves, and find alternative housing. Within these 12 months, they would either become self-supporting and move off of the GRH program, or they would likely be certified as permanently disabled and begin receiving SSI payments and remain eligible for general group residential housing. So once again, thanks for the opportunity to be here. As the coordinator to end homelessness, I believe that this change is a very important one. It would greatly increase people's self-confidence, self-esteem, their ability to contribute in the community. I think it's also important because it will also help transition people off of a program that they may not need indefinitely, but otherwise are staying on for fear of losing their housing. This is important, I think, for all people. I think it's especially important for young adults, some of whom we've heard from today. Many young adults do suffer from some mental health issues and get housed through the group residential housing program. We certainly don't want those young adults to not go to work and get that important work experience and stay in this program indefinitely. We want them to move on, and this legislation helps us do that. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Tendrick. Ms.
I'm Kristen Brown with St. Stephen's Human Services. I oversee the long-term housing programs for single adults at St. Stephen's, and we have used GRH to house about 90 long-term homeless single adults. All of them are disabled, most of them with a mental illness. We started about 2 years ago, so some of our longest-term participants have been housed for 2 years, and they are at the point where they have stabilized their mental health. They are wanting to work. They have completed some schooling. They have addressed some of their health issues and really do want to work. But for a person who's been homeless for many years in the past, the idea of going to work and losing their GRH support keeps them from making that step to work because they don't want to lose their housing. I think this bill gives people the opportunity to test out work to make sure that they can do it on their own and maintain their housing on their own in the future.
So when the person gets a job, they're allowed to earn up to what level and still stay in group residential? 700 something, you said?
The GRH limit is $776.
And what level are they being kicked out now?
People who are on the GRH program receive $101 for their own personal needs. That would not change with this legislation.
But right now, before this, as soon as they get a job, they're kicked out regardless of the income?
As soon as they make $300
okay.
per month.
So it's, in effect, this is keeping them in from 300 up till 776.
Exactly.
And is the 1 year from the time they get that job?
That's my understanding, yeah.
Senator Kielash, do you have any questions?
I don't think so.
Me either. Senator Kielash, move Senate file 1166 is amended, recommend it pass, and where does that go? My committee?
It goes back to the committee where it came from, your committee, I believe. So, yes. I hope you have time to hear it.
We'll get there. no discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Thank you.
Aye.
I better say aye.
Need somebody. Sorry. Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you. You have one more bill.
Yes, I do. Senate file 1552. It's the Neighborhood Renewal Act. This bill is to act on relating to housing, providing rehabilitation of housing that is vacant, abandoned as a result of foreclosure crisis, and protecting the health and safety and welfare of the community through appropriate police powers, providing legal process to appoint receivers of abandoned properties, and to recover funds expended to bring the property up to code, proposing coding for new laws, Minnesota statutes, chapter 463. This bill is to try to maintain housing that is currently being a blight on our communities, and I will I'm sorry, there's an amendment, A1 amendment. Forgot about
Senator
that.
Kielash moves A1,
moves
amendment.
A1 amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
On a 1-0 vote, it prevails.
Mr. Chair, I got Craig Johnson from the Housing Policy Coordinator for Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers here to testify.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Johnson, and I represent the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, also known as MCCD. MCCD represents 43 community development organizations throughout the Twin Cities that are engaged in the work of affordable housing and small business development. I'm here today on behalf of MCCD and our member organizations to show support for Senate File 1552, the Neighborhood Renewal Act. In the midst of a financial crisis that has its roots in the housing industry, we are seeing the effects on our communities of an alarming number of foreclosed, vacant, and blighted properties. I'm sure you're aware of the many effects that such properties can have on our communities, including decreased property values, increased crime, and burdens on local government. The Neighborhood Renewal Act will provide a legal process to help communities take control of abandoned properties. Through this act, if a current property owner does not provide a specific and credible plan to rehabilitate a property that is vacant and or blighted, a receiver can be appointed to rehabilitate the property under court supervision and ultimately recover the funds expended to bring the properties up to code in a timely manner. The bill will provide one more tool to help communities and community organizations address key blighted properties that are causing devastation in our communities. Moreover, it will help our communities become healthier and lay the foundation for becoming more prosperous by turning problem properties into key community assets. It works like this. If a government entity or nonprofit organization identifies a vacant or blighted property that is causing a real problem within a community, a hearing can be sought in front of the court that would require the owner to bring the property up to code or have a receiver appointed. If the owner does not respond or does not present a credible plan for rehabilitation, the court can appoint a receiver to rehabilitate the property. Costs for repairs can be recovered by the receiver, similar to recovering costs when a city is forced to shovel a sidewalk, haul garbage off a property, or mow grass. If receivership does become necessary, the receiver gets final approval from the court, which will make sure all repairs were necessary and all costs were reasonable. A lien is placed on the property, and it is submitted to the owner, and the owner has 90 days to pay the bill. If the owner does not make a full payment within 90 days, the bill is converted into a first lien on the property. Once this happens, the receiver has the right to continue to collect, or the receiver can foreclose. Even if the receiver chooses to foreclose, the owner still has the unconditional right to redeem for the amount owed. A good way to think about this tool provided to communities under this act is that it is simply another means of enforcing building code standards. The owner of a vacant or blighted property subject to this act could continue to hold on to his or her property by demonstrating his or her prospective ability to renovate the property. If the owner does not act, the act would allow the court, in its discretion, to appoint a receiver as a means of achieving code compliance. With that, I thank you for your time. And I'm joined here by Sherry Pugh Sullivan and Jane Bowman. Sherry will speak to some of the community impacts of this issue, and Jane will answer any is here to help answer questions.
Thank you. Ms. Pugh Sullivan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Ms. Chair and members. My name is Sherry Pugh Sullivan. I'm the Executive Director of the Northside Residents Redevelopment Council. We are the oldest resident council in the city of Minneapolis, founded in 1969. We are also the original demonstration project for mortgage foreclosure, which now is a statewide program in the state of Minnesota. In our neighborhoods, which are in North Minneapolis, the two most specific, Willard Hay and Near North, although we do provide services of mortgage foreclosure counseling to all 13 neighborhoods in North Minneapolis. We have been observing since 1988, and there are maps to kind of give you a sense of what has happened, the levels of predatory and subprime lending that has occurred in our community. We see this obviously through our foreclosure counseling, but we also see the effects of this visually as we drive through the neighborhood every day when we're working there. It is important to us that this bill be given consideration. For the last 4 years, we've been here at the legislature talking about mortgage foreclosure issues as well as nuisance property issues. We know that while there is an abundance of money, it seems, that's been appropriated at the federal level to assist with mortgage foreclosures and acquisition of foreclosed properties, it really does not address the devastation of the problem in our community. We have seen the doubling of foreclosures in North Minneapolis starting in 2004. It went from 100 to 200 to 200 to 400, 400 to up to 1,000 in 2008. And so what we know is that there are still properties in our community in which they will not be resolved with the current funding or funding in the future. This bill provides another opportunity of intervention at the local neighborhood level to address the nuisance properties which have literally been walked away from. To give you an example, on Girard Avenue in our community, there is a three-story duplex house. It has been vacant since 2001. At any time, you could walk to this house, open the door, go in, and tour through. Now, sometimes you might encounter someone because over the years, the beer cans went from just being at floor level to about 2 feet in height and depth. But clearly, there was occupancy, not legal occupancy. Next door to this house was a vacant lot, and two doors down was a vacant lot. In 2005, we had private builders who came in and said, we want to help, bring new homeowners to the community. They built two brand new homes. Those homes could not sell because of the impact of the vacant property. The vacant property owner was approached by both of the builders, by other individuals in the community, who refused to sell, refused to lock up, but he paid his taxes. And it's that kind of property that causes ongoing issues in our community, along with the issues that we're facing with foreclosure and the vacancies that occur from that. So I know that I need to be brief, and I won't go into all my comments. The map before you is a study that we had done by the University of Minnesota, and what it shows you is from 1988 through 2002. And what you can see is that our communities in North Minneapolis consistently have been the focus of predatory lending and subprime loans over and over again. In 2000, you'll see that it was a little bit more spread out into parts of Hennepin County. But when you get to 2002, those shadows are gone in most of Hennepin County. And we think that that's probably the result of the fact that there was an interest rate and people in this county basically refinanced to ARMs, which are now becoming a big issue in the county. But always you see the concentration in the near north neighborhoods of North Minneapolis. The last two pages is to give you an example of what happens in a community where there's lending at the level that we see, in which you can see that the number of sheriff sales in it since 1988, and then the other one shows you how loans were refinanced with subprime loans on the same two blocks. And so with those comments, I'll end and take any questions later.
Thank you, Ms. Pugh-Sullivan. And Ms. Bowman, are you just here to answer questions or?
Senator Marty, that's correct. I have no prepared remarks. I'm here to answer any technical questions the committee might have.
Welcome back to the Senate. My only question is when the house goes vacant, and right now you say it's like if they keep paying the property taxes, you never get the property. But if this steps in, what's the fastest, once you have a abandoned property, what's the fastest you could have this occur?
Senator Marty, and members of the committee, once a receiver has been appointed, the receiver has 90 days to place a lien on the property. And after a lien has been placed on the property, the homeowner has another 90 days to pay that lien, or that lien will be turned into a super priority lien. And at that point, the owner would be able to follow the already in statute, foreclosure statutes, to go through the foreclosure process.
And Ms. Bowman, the group that is appointed the receiver, it has to be a nonprofit, right? That was.
Or a city.
Or a city. And can they, what do they do with it while they're going through this process? Can they can, when do they start making repairs, right? When they take control of it?
Possibly, yes. They have to present a plan to a third-party neutral or a judge, and the judge has to approve that. And the judge would declare that, in fact, the property needed to be brought up to code and that such and such repairs are necessary and the costs are reasonable. And at that point, they can start making the repairs.
And Ms. Pugh-Sullivan, your group and some other groups are ready to, you're eagerly waiting to be able to do this.
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I've had there's folks that were interested in speaking against it, the bankers associations and realtors that are concerned about the lien requirements. Those should be going to the Judiciary Committee, and Senator Mao is asked to see those. Time might be a problem at this time, but I believe that we can take those up under the Judiciary when we get a hearing there. So.
And this bill go back through my committee or through the Senate? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And we have a couple others who would like to speak to the bill.
Okay.
Good morning, Senator Marty and committee members. Sue Watlow-Phillip, Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing and the president and owner of a consulting company. I'm supporting the bill, and let me just very quickly say why it's so important that this bill is passed. We had $58 million come into this state through the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. There's more money that's available on the federal government for communities to apply for competitively. How the state and many communities are utilizing these dollars is to demolish housing and to land bank it. The reason is because the property has gotten into such disrepair that it's no longer, it's too costly to rehab it. This bill will allow us to utilize those federal dollars, get control of that property much more quickly and maintain that housing as a rental housing asset as well as a home ownership asset. Elam, in conjunction with the Minneapolis Urban League and Ethnic Homes, put in a $2.25 million proposal to the city of Minneapolis for the neighborhood stabilization programs, those federal dollars, to do just that, is to keep that housing available for rental housing and home ownership. We know every day that housing is vacant, that it's going to take more dollars to rehab those units. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Butler-Phipps.
Yes. Mr. Chair, honorable senators, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, president and executive director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers. We help children, families, the elderly, the disabled, and victims statewide, nationally, and even locally. In the areas as far as education, health care, housing, shelters, and so forth. I just wanted to make a comment because we see ourselves as being on both sides of the issue. First, we do understand as far as the need to rehab and to put people in the housing that need to be in the housing and so forth. But on the other hand, we have some concerns about the track that this takes people onto as far as we've handled cases that we've been on the other side trying to prevent a homeowner who's been elderly or disabled from having their home taken by this manner. A couple years back, you heard of the eminent domain case when an elderly couple, I believe in Anoka, was run through a process and they had to fight it, and there was some legislation around eminent domain. I think what's needed here is that there's people who are low income, disabled, and elderly who need assistance with the process. They may want their houses rehab, but they don't have the funds to do it, and there needs to be some process that the government and others are willing to work with to get them to the state where their homes are not taken by this method. They also need some reasonable mediation, because when you talk about attorney's fees, we've seen cases where they were on the other side and they couldn't fight the attorneys and they have lost their homes. We're concerned about the snowbirds who will stay away for 6 months at a time, who will not get the notices either by mail, or they might be on vacation and they've had their homes broken into on the belief that it was abandoned or vacant. We have concerns about, now the mayor of Eden Prairie, we understand, has a majority or quite a few homes that reach the state where they need rehab and they're owned by the elderly. So there will be others in other areas besides Minneapolis who will have people facing these kinds of problems, and there needs to be some safety net for them that they aren't being hit by this process and having their homes taken away. There's also the issue as far as the people who are fighting insurance companies, where insurance companies aren't paying for fixing up their homes that have been damaged, and so it meets the conditions as far as what you're talking about here, needing rehab. So I ask that a process be inserted to address these populations and problems. Thank you.
Senator Kielash, do you care to comment?
I think this is a work in progress, and I think it's going to be heard in other committees where some of the concerns of legality and that, and also where support services could be added to it. I think that we just, I'd like to just move this on to back to the committee where it came from and let them go through the process of moving to the proper committees for judiciary, et cetera. So
these issues, and you're
they need to be aired with folks that have better legal minds than mine.
And you're planning to engage in those discussions
when
from here, if I'm not mistaken, it goes back to the health committee.
To go back to Senator Marty's committee. Yes.
So, Senator, did you have additional witnesses?
I did not, unless somebody else signed up.
Senator Kielash moves Senate File 1552 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health.
As amended, did you amend it?
Yes, is it amended?
As amended. Anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator DeKalb's motion, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator DeKalb. There being no further business before this committee, it stands adjourned.